Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Susan Moles. My articles and all past shows can be found at my website. I encourage you to go there at SusanKnowles.com, and that's Susan, KNOWLES.com. There's a lot going on right now in the news, as you're aware, with ISIS, or as Obama would like to refer to them as the JV team, which we all know doesn't even come close to describing who they really are. So tonight we have a special guest who joins us for the first half hour, and he's written a book called ISIS Exposed, Beheadings, Slavery, and the Hellish Reality of Radical Islam, and he's here to give us the facts. As you know, the chat room is always open. You can comment or ask questions there, or you can call in at 347-205-9620. Our guest tonight is Eric Stackelbeck. And his website, if you want to find out more about him and the work and the articles that he writes, is ericstackelbeck.com, ericstackelbeck.com. Let me tell you just a little bit about him before we bring him on. He's an acclaimed investigative reporter and a sought-after authority on terrorism and national security. He's a correspondent and terrorism analyst for CBN News. He's the host of the weekly program, The Watchman, with Eric Stackelbeck. He covers the global war on terror, U.S. national security, the Middle East, and the growth of radical Islam at home and abroad for the network's Washington, D.C. Bureau. He's made hundreds of appearances as a commentator on leading national television and radio shows. He's been featured on Hannity, Your World with Neil Cavuto, Fox and Friends, The O'Reilly Factor, America's Newsroom, The Kelly File, CNN Newsroom, and many, many more. He's the best-selling author of The Terrorist Next Door, How the Government is Deceiving You About the Islamist Threat, and The Brotherhood, America's Next Great Enemy. And as I told you just now, he has this new book out called ISIS Exposed. So I want to get right in there and bring him on right now. Eric, good evening.
Hi, Susan. Good evening. Great to be with you.
I'm so glad that you could be with us today. I know we have a lot to cover in a very short period of time. I want to let you know I've read your book cover to cover, and I can really tell our audience that that book is one that I've learned more about, you know, ISIS from than any other source out there, including mainstream media or this administration or anything else. So
thank you so much, Susan,
for writing such a great book. You're very welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. And you live to tell about it. You finished it. You live to tell about it. Wow.
I know.
My wife says she doesn't know if she wants to read it. It's too heavy. But, hey, it had to be written.
Great.
Thank you.
And you did a great job. And I want to jump right in and ask if you could explain to our audience a little bit about, you know, how ISIS came to be and who they are.
Yeah, you know, Susan, I always say when I'm talking about this book that we shouldn't even be having this conversation, because if you rewind to 2007, 2008, whether you disagree with the Iraq War, agree with it, one thing is clear, the troop surge worked. The U.S. Mm-hmm. troop surge crushed al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, fast forward to December 2011, and I include the timeline in the book. President Obama, against the advice of all of his top generals, withdrew every last U.S. troop from Iraq. And Susan, almost simultaneously, as soon as the last U.S. boots left the ground, almost simultaneously, a wave of suicide bombings began. Assassinations of Iraqi leaders began. All of a sudden, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had been crushed, rose again from the ashes, spread its tentacles next door into Syria, grew and grew into the beast we have today, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. President Obama, again, was warned time and time again by his top generals, by diplomats, by people on both sides of the political aisle. He knew that this ISIS storm was gathering, yet he goes on national television in January 2014 and calls ISIS the JV team of terrorism. Well, Susan, that JV team now covers 35,000 square miles of territory in the heart of the Middle East. That's an area the size of Great Britain. That's astounding.
That is astounding. And can you tell us a little bit about what ISIS is doing and what their goal is? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, number one, they have accomplished in part what the goal of every radical Islamic group around the world. They have declared a caliphate in the middle of the Middle East. Now, for everyone listening who might not know, it's a funny word, I know, caliphate, but very important, very central to the jihadist ideology. Basically, what ISIS wants to do is establish an Islamic super state, a borderless state where every Muslim nation would be united economically, militarily, and politically to take on Israel and take on the West. Now, they're starting small, not so small, 35,000 miles, again, not small. They rule over 8 million people. But compared to the caliphates of old, what ISIS has established now is small. The caliphates of old conquered Spain, Sicily, Eastern Europe, drove to the gates of Vienna twice, drove into central France. ISIS wants to repeat all of that. Yes, they're starting relatively small now in comparison to past caliphates, but the ultimate goal is to have a caliphate stretching from India all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, conquering all lands that were once under the caliphate, and basically making the entire world, putting the entire world under the sway, under the rule of Islamic Sharia law. That's the end game. That's what ISIS is driving for.
And you talk about in your book about the, you know, the ISIS recruitment process. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what they're looking for, who do they go after, that type of thing?
Right. You know, Susan, this is the most fascinating, and I think for our listeners here in the United States, the most central part of the book. And really, this is why I wrote the book, because a lot of times people see what's going on in the Middle East, and they say, hey, you know what, it doesn't affect me. It's thousands of miles away. Why should I care? Well, I'll get to the recruitment in a second, but here's an idea of the success ISIS is having on American soil. Just last month, the FBI director, James Comey, made a stunning statement. He said that in all 50 U.S. states right now, we have active investigations into ISIS-related activity. So that means in every state in the union right now, including Alaska and Hawaii, we have a network of ISIS sympathizers and supporters. That's according to our FBI director. So the barbarians are not just at the gates, they're inside the gates. And here's how the recruitment process works, Susan. Fascinating and chilling to hear firsthand. In Minnesota, of all places, look, the frozen tundra of the upper Midwest, the Twin Cities in particular, Minneapolis and St. Paul, have become a breeding ground for Islamic terrorism. Dozens of people have left Minneapolis and St. Paul over the past few years to travel overseas and join terror groups like ISIS. And I spoke to a law enforcement source on the ground in St. Paul who said, look, Eric, this is how it works. You'll have an ISIS recruiter. He'll go into a mosque or a local rec center. He'll identify some 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, Somali Muslims, generally, Susan. Look, Minneapolis, St. Paul may shock some people to know, has the largest Somali Muslim population in the entire country, in all of North America. 100,000 Somali Muslims live there. So first the recruiter will befriend them, then the radicalization process starts, and here's the bill of goods they're sold. Basically, the recruiter will say, come to the caliphate, join us, you'll be a glorious holy warrior, the entire world will know your name, you will be a rock star in the Middle East. And to an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, that can be an alluring message. That's part of it. The other part of the recruitment process, which we can talk about, social media.
And I think that's really important for everybody to know, because I think, you know, you don't think about ISIS using social media to talk to people, because we're used to seeing the old films of, you know, just somebody sitting in a grainy film of one of the ISIS leaders talking. So, yeah, please tell us more about that.
Yeah, Susan, yeah, so there's two legs, really, to the recruitment process. Number one, on the ground, just traditional on the ground in the mosques, et cetera, the recruitment goes on, or you know, the connection will be made at the mosque and then off mosque grounds, take a kid to a restaurant, radicalize him, make sure he gets on the plane, put money in his pocket, make sure he meets a fixer in Turkey who can transit him into Syria. Very interesting how it works. But the social media is what really sets ISIS apart from other terrorist movements, Susan, because ISIS is the most media-savvy terrorist organization we've ever seen. Look, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, ISIS is all over it, and they send out 90 tweets per minute. I mean, that's amazing how plugged in they are. And their social media and their propaganda arms are run by Westerners, people who were raised in our culture, who know exactly how to speak to a Western English-speaking audience. ISIS also pours thousands of dollars. I talk about this in the book, how they throw thousands of dollars into these propaganda films, these slickly produced propaganda films that look like a Hollywood action flick. And really, Susan, that's the goal, because in our culture, in the West, Europe, the United States, the past few decades, we have this situation now where kids are playing violent video games where they're chopping heads on the video screen. They're watching just horrifically gory horror movies with realistic torture scenes, and they see what ISIS is doing with the beheadings and burnings, and they're desensitized to it. And there's a slice of people here in the West who are not repulsed by it. They're actually attracted to it, and that actually helps ISIS recruit, if you can believe it.
Wow. And so they're not these poor people just looking for a job. If we give them a job, they'll stop doing this, as Obama said.
No, Susan, yeah, that's a new big government program, Jobs for Jihadists. That's next on the Obama administration agenda. I mean, this is outrageous, Susan. I'm glad you brought that up, because President Obama gave a speech a few weeks ago saying, look, the jihadists have, quote, legitimate grievances, and they're doing what they're doing because of a lack of economic opportunity in the Muslim world. Well, in the book, I outline how medical students, business majors, people from affluent suburban communities right here in the United States have traveled to join ISIS overseas, not because of lack of economic opportunity or poverty, but because of ideology. Terrorism is only a tactic. It is driven by ideology. It's an ideology President Obama refuses to acknowledge even exists.
And why do you think that he refuses to say this has anything to do with Islam? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think there's a few dimensions to that. I think, number one, the entire administration is absolutely crippled by political correctness. That's the easy answer. We know they're PC to the core. But President Obama is a hard, hard left-wing guy. I mean, he is a radical, revolutionary leftist. I don't think that's a stretch to say that. This is a man who said he wants to fundamentally transform America. That's a revolutionary
right.
statement. And what he's doing in the Middle East right now is part of that. He sees America and Israel as the bad guys, as the problems in the Middle East. We are the imperialist powers who have oppressed these poor, unfortunate, dispossessed Muslims. And look, legitimate grievances the Muslims have against us now, we need to be knocked down a peg. That's his view. And he fancies himself, apparently, as the defender of Islam. He obviously, his father, his stepfather were Muslims. He grew up in Indonesia, went to a Muslim school. He's obviously fond of Islam. I mean, that's clear.
Right.
And at the end
clear.
Of the day, the goal, yeah, I mean, he will not criticize any aspect of Islam at all. I mean, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Look, even moderate Muslims will tell you, yes, we have a problem right now in our religion with a significant slice of our religion is radicalized and they're jihadist. He won't even acknowledge that it exists. I mean, Obama, and look, it's not going to change before 2016, Susan. He is not going to budge. This is who he is. He refuses to acknowledge any theological, any Islamic component whatsoever to Islamic terrorism. But he loves to take pot shots at Christianity and at Israel every chance he gets.
Every single chance, yeah. And I think it just gets worse. And I think we're going to see probably just, you know, more of the same and if not worse in what he's doing. And, you know, Iran and negotiating with them is one thing that I'm going to be talking about later, my opinions on that. I also want to talk to you, too, about what are the threats, you know, the threats that we have to Americans and to, you know, Europe as well when these recruited people return home.
Yeah, Susan, great point. We've had 180 U.S. citizens leave their comfortable homes here in America to travel to Iraq and Syria and join this caliphate. We've had at least 3,500 Western Europeans, Brits, French, Germans, probably more than that, travel to Iraq and Syria. Now, if they don't get killed waging jihad over there, one day they will return home. And these U.S.
Mm-hmm.
citizens, U.S. passport holders, fresh off of slicing heads in Syria, they're probably not going to transition peacefully back into civilian life here and get a job at a gas station. They're going to continue the jihad here. I'll give you a great example. In Paris in January, the two killers, the terrorists there, had trained in Yemen, came back to France well-armed, well-trained, and radicalized. What ISIS wants to do, and I outline this strategy in the book, is they want to turn the U.S. and Western Europe into guerrilla war zones, where you're seeing a Boston bombing, a Fort Hood, a Paris-style attack on a regular basis on U.S. soil in American cities. And at the end of the day, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to walk into a shopping mall, yell Allahu Akbar, and open fire. That is the blueprint
right.
now. And ISIS is explicitly calling on its followers here in the United States. They call them city wolves to raise up and do exactly this. Smaller scale, low tech attacks, but on a consistent basis. That would be the definition of terror.
Now, you talk in your book about the 20-year plan for Al-Qaeda. Can you explain that a little bit and tell us where we are kind of right now on that timeline?
Yes, Susan, we're deep into it. Look, in 2000, Al-Qaeda put together, like any good business, put together its goals, put together its strategy from the years 2000 to the year 2020, a 20-year plan. The plan had seven phases. Now, the fifth phase is what we are in right now. Al-Qaeda said that between the years 2012 and 2016, they intended to establish a caliphate. Well, that's exactly what ISIS did last year. A caliphate was declared in June 2014. And remember, ISIS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. The next
right.
phase, 2016 to 2020, Al-Qaeda called total confrontation. And with this network of supporters and sympathizers throughout the West, with ISIS gaining ground in the Middle East, with ISIS gaining satellites throughout North Africa and the Middle East, whether it's Pakistan, Afghanistan, Egypt, Sinai Peninsula, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Nigeria, ISIS is adding new franchises. They're getting ready. they're gearing up for total confrontation 2016 to 2020. If you look at the way things are shaping up, Susan, we are right on course, I'm sad to say, and President Obama has hastened it with his policies, if I can even call them policies, in the Middle East and North Africa. They're not policies, that they're absolute chaos.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also talked about an interview that you had, I believe it was in January of 2014, the one I'm talking about, but he was a former CIA case officer who ran operations around the world, and he had a major concern of his for ISIS.
Yeah, we're talking about the threat to America, Susan. I'm glad you brought this up. This guy was a CIA clandestine services officer, like you said, for 30 years, served in hot spots around the world. And he said, Eric, the thing that keeps me up at night is the possibility that an ISIS jihadist with a chemical or biological agent will smuggle it across that porous southern border and set it off in a U.S. city. Now, it's been 13 and a half years since 9/11, and our borders are still not only unsecured, I mean, they're wide open. You might as well have a neon sign flashing on the southern border saying, jihadists welcome. You cannot sustain yourself long term as a nation state if you refuse to secure your borders. And Susan, if we're talking about it and we see it, you better believe ISIS sees it. And the intent is there, and you have to believe that jihadists have crossed that border. We have more and more people from Muslim countries being apprehended at the border. I've spoken to border agents who say, look, all sorts of people are coming over that border from Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Iran. It's a disaster waiting to happen.
Absolutely. And you also talked about in your book, and something that I didn't know it had a label, but you called it demographic jihad. Can you explain that? Because that was excellent.
Well, we are far, far down that road in Western Europe, Susan. Demographic jihad is basically pretty simple. Indigenous Europeans do not reproduce. They have 1.8, maybe 2 children per couple. You have waves and waves of Muslim immigrants, on the other hand, who are coming to the shores of Western Europe. They're not showing any inclination, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, there's no inclination to assimilate, to integrate, and they're having a lot of kids. So when the indigenous Europeans aren't reproducing, and the waves, literally waves of Muslim immigrants who are arriving in Europe every day with no desire to assimilate are having lots of kids, then you have a big problem on your hands. I've walked in these European neighborhoods in places like East London and Germany and France and Brussels, and I've been in these Islamic enclaves where really they're self-segregating areas where there's, you don't feel like you're in the West, to be quite honest, in some of these neighborhoods. It's a big problem that Europe has, and my fear is that it's coming here. In the United States, the Muslim population is exploding, no pun intended, and mosques are being built from coast to coast. The Obama administration obviously has hastened it considerably in the past 6.5 years. And like I said earlier, Susan, that Somali Muslim population, largely unassimilated in Minnesota, I fear that it may be a harbinger for things to come. We've traditionally assimilated immigrants in this country very well, but with the waves of Muslim immigrants now coming, all bets are off.
Well, I know you also talk about how that a lot of those people that are in those communities too, like in Europe and coming here, they take welfare, payments from the government at the same time that they're, plotting against us and doing things against us.
Yeah, this is so amazing. Susan, I spoke to one jihadist, I guess you would say ideologue in particular. His name is Anjum Chowdhury. The name may be familiar. He's been on Fox News. He's been on CBN with me. This guy is probably the most notorious radical Islamist in Great Britain. A very well-educated guy, very well-spoken, but completely sinister and evil. And he says he collects welfare benefits. He calls for the downfall of the British state. He calls for Sharia law to be instituted in Great Britain. Yet at the same time, he collects welfare benefits from the British government. And he calls it a form of jihad. Look, you're bleeding the Fidel government dry. You're on the welfare rolls. Keep doing it. He said, look, I asked him, what do you do all day? He said, this is what I do. I walk around, I rabble rouse, I speak to the media, and I collect welfare benefits. This is the West. This is happening not only in Britain. It's happening in places like Denmark, France, Germany. And if we're not careful, it's going to happen here too.
And in the time we have left, we have about 5 minutes left, I know, before you have to go. Can you, and it's a lot to talk about in 5 minutes, but can you tell us a little bit about what's happening to the Jews in Europe and the Christians in the Middle East right now?
Two legs of the same horrific dilemma, Susan. Look, in Europe, we'll start with, Jews have never been in a more precarious position since World War II. We're seeing just massive, massive increases in violent, genocidal anti-Semitism. Not only physical attacks on Jews and synagogues, but verbal and written attacks. And it is driven by that large Muslim population in Europe, combined with the radical left in Europe. It's an unholy alliance. I saw it up close in Brussels, where the Israeli embassy, when I visited, was basically like a, I don't want to say a fortified bunker, but man, it was heavily, heavily secured. This is Brussels, the capital of Europe. Yet there's such security concerns for attacks against Jews that that was the situation. And you're going to see more and more aliyah. You're going to see more and more Jews leave Europe and go to Israel. It's happening now. In terms of Christians in the Middle East, we're seeing an open genocide against Christians in the Middle East, in the birthplace of Christianity, in the cradle of the faith. ISIS makes no bones about it. They want to liquidate the Christians of the Middle East. It's very reminiscent of what Hitler did during World War II. And by the way, what the Iranian regime does today. They're announcing what they want to do. And in the case of ISIS, they're doing it in real time now. I talk to people in the book, firsthand accounts, Susan, of children, Christian children being beheaded, Christian women being enslaved, sex slaves. This is happening now. If you're a Christian, to your brothers and sisters in Christ in the Middle East, it's happening now.
And you know, in talking with about the Jews, you know, the anti-Semitism here in, you know, I'm in California, and in the UC system, it's really starting, it's growing. It's amazing.
Yes. It is. The UC system is notorious. Yes.
And so, what do you think is the strategy that we should be following when it comes to ISIS?
Susan, here's what I think. Number one, smash this caliphate militarily. Smash it. Decisively destroy ISIS in the Middle East. They have 30 to 40,000 jihadists in this caliphate. Hey, that's a formidable fighting force in the Middle East, but it's no match for the U.S. military. This is not an 800-pound gorilla. We can smash ISIS decisively like we did to the German war machine and the Japanese war machine during World War II. That is what needs to be done. It sounds simplistic, but it's really not that complicated. And by the way, you don't need a heavy U.S. footprint. You know, I spoke to military strategists in the book, Susan, who said, hey, airstrikes alone can't work. It's not going to work. You need some kind of ground presence. But look at 2001 in Afghanistan. We had special forces. We had the CIA on the ground directing the Northern Alliance. They routed the Taliban. We can do the same thing today in Iraq and Syria. We have the Kurds, who are fierce fighters, who are very pro-American. We have Assyrian Christians. We have a moderate Iraqi Sunni tribe. Some are actually moderate, and they want to fight ISIS. They're all looking for U.S. leadership. They're looking for the leader of the free world to step up. It's not happening. They're outgunned. They're outmanned. ISIS is using U.S. weaponry that they seized from the Iraqi army. We have vacated any position as the leader of the free world. These people are dying. We could end this now. We could smash ISIS. We could do it now. We're not going to do it. President Obama doesn't have the will or the desire to do it. It's just a distraction from him, from transforming America, from his domestic agenda. And it's really shameful as an American to see what's unfolding, because this is an existential evil. It is evil that must be destroyed, and the West doesn't have the guts to confront it. The only man who does is the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a very Churchillian-type figure who sees the gathering storm. And what has the West done? They've shunned him. It's a world turned upside down where everything evil is good and everything good is evil.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think here in America, we're just like those people looking for leadership. You know, we're looking for leadership too, and it's been missing for 6 years. And you know, I love what you call Obama's ISIS strategy in your book. You call it golf and awe. And that really does explain what the strategy is.
You can only laugh, right? I mean, either that or you'll cry.
It's
that bad.
Absurd.
I never thought we'd see the day, you know, when an American president, I mean, he's an enemy of Israel. He is an enemy of Israel. Clearly an enemy
absolutely.
Of Israel.
And
unabashed,
gonna...
and he's a friend to jihadists, to the Iranian jihadists.
I think we are going to see more, you know, sort of whatever punishment in whatever form coming towards Netanyahu in Israel, and it's gonna increase. You know, Eric, I want to thank you so much. I know you have to run. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Your book is again absolutely wonderful. I'm glad that you could come on. And
thanks. I appreciate any time.
Yeah, great. And I look forward to the next book you write. I want everybody to go out and get this book and all the other books too, because again, if you really want to know about ISIS and what's coming and what's really going on, get Eric's book. And again, you can find more information at ericstackelbeck.com. And Eric, you know, best wishes to you on this book
you
and
too.
The next book. And thanks for the work you do.
You too. God bless. Thanks, Susan. Take care.
God bless. Take care.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye-bye. So there you have it. You had to go after that half hour. So I really want to talk to you a little bit more on things. You know, I really meant that about his book. His book is amazing. It really lays it out there for you. You know, we've heard so much of, ISIS really isn't Islam. They're just wonderful people and da-da-da-da-da. You know, Eric lays out example after example of things and why we should be concerned about these people. And he didn't have time to talk about it, but you know, there's different groups. We sometimes think, why are Muslims fighting Muslims? You know, what's that all about? You know, there are Shias and then there are Sunnis and they hate each other. But it's so scary where those, you know, people could end up really kind of working together because their goal is to kill everyone who isn't a believer in Allah or make them a believer. I want to switch a little bit, and it kind of goes along with what we're talking about. You know, my concern for the United States in regards to the Iran nuclear treaty that we're so involved in, that we so much want to see happen by March 31st. You know, tomorrow is the deadline. We're told that it's most likely going to go down to the wire. We've been told that, you know, over and over that Iran keeps making demand after demand. And guess what we're doing? We're giving them what they want, you know, everything just so that we can get a deal. And I want to ask you, because, you know, have you ever stopped to ask yourself why we are negotiating with Iran in the first place? You know, some people have speculated that Obama thinks he can use the help of Iran to stop ISIS. But as I said, you know, Iran has its own agenda, which pertains to the caliphate, and some believe could actually join with ISIS down the road, as I said, in the common goal of controlling the world under Sharia law in the name of Allah. And we're negotiating with Iran at the same time that we're supporting Saudi Arabia as they fight. You know, recently we over the weekend we heard about everything going on in Yemen, and that is basically Iran in the Houthis in Yemen, who are fighting, you know, moving their way towards Saudi Arabia. So here we are sitting down at a negotiating table with our friend Iran, and I say that friend in quotes, as they're supporting our other friend, you know, Saudi Arabia, and we're helping Saudi Arabia battle against the Iranians who are coming over towards the southern peninsula in Saudi Arabia. So it's crazy what's happening right now. And we're supposed to just sit there and look at it and go, oh, you know, don't worry, Obama's got it all under control. We don't have to worry. We don't need Congress. We can just wait. He can go over there, you know, have his team go over with John Kerry and carry on these negotiations and get us a good deal. As I said, things are just absolutely crazy. And I wrote a book a couple of years ago, long before this stuff ever began, and it's called Freedom Fight, A Call to Remember. It's a fiction, but honestly, you know, it involves some of the things that we're seeing right now in our government, how it seems crazy what they're doing, and basically where we're going to end up if it doesn't stop. My book, basically, if things have come to pass already. I don't claim to be any type of prophet, but I don't think you have to be too, you know, you have to be blind not to see what's coming. And I recently wrote an article about how absolutely ridiculous it is for us to be sitting down right now and negotiating with Iran. And the best way that I can kind of explain to you my feelings about it is, you know, remember when you were a small kid, probably in elementary school, and you had a best friend, and one day, you know, your friend just for whatever reason stole some pencils or erasers out of your backpack, or you happened to leave them down and stole them from you. And you were sitting there like in disbelief. How could this happen? I thought we were friends. So you couldn't wait to get home and tell your mother, you know, oh my gosh, you know, Mikey stole my pencils and my eraser. And what am I supposed to do, Mom? You know, you're so young, you don't understand what you really should do and how to look at things. And your mom basically said, you know what? Your friend Mikey, you thought he was your friend, but you know what? It doesn't look like he was. So from now on, what I want you to do is I don't want to leave your erasers and pencils out. You can't trust him. So don't trust him anymore. It's kind of that old adage that we all kind of remember, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So I think in this case, the Obama administration hasn't yet learned that same lesson when it comes to Iran. And let me give you some examples why. I think many of you probably remember back to November 1979. And that's when a group of Iranian students stormed our U.S. embassy in Tehran, and they took more than 60 American hostages. And they quickly kind of let 14 of them go due to health reasons and some because they were women and that type of thing. But the remaining hostages stayed there 444 days. And who could forget Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter and, you know, the cause of really, well, I won't say all of it, but, oh, maybe 90% of it. When he decided to allow the Shah of Iran, who had been ousted, allowed him to come over to the United States and seek medical treatment. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And these people, you know, went ahead and just decided, I've had enough of America, had enough of you trying to tell us what to do, allowing this Shah that we, you know, ousted to come to your country and be treated for his medical issues there. It was just enough. And so then we go on from 79 into 1980, and we have the Iran-Iraqi War under President Ronald Reagan, in which the U.S. sold arms to Iraq in its fight against Iran in protecting the national security interests. There's reason number two. In 1983, 17 Americans were killed at a U.S. embassy when Hezbollah, who is Iran, bombed the embassy. And at that time, 241 U.S. peacekeepers in Lebanon were killed. And yet, we sit today at a table negotiating with Iran. But let me keep going. In 1988, the U.S. launched an attack against Iran in retaliation for the Iranian mining of areas that had to do with the land in the Persian Gulf. And then again in 1995, the United States placed a trade embargo on Iran. And I think that was probably one of the things that Bill Clinton did right. He was the one who placed that trade embargo on them and restricted commercial relations with them. Didn't restrict relationship with himself, with Monica Lewinsky, but with Iran he did. So he made one decision correct. The sanctions, again, were then renewed by President George W. Bush. And he cited for his reason in doing so because of unusual and extraordinary threat that Iran was to the American national security interest. And that, again, that wasn't that long ago. It was 1995. Then, again, in 1996, Iran, again, once again through Hezbollah, was accused of the Khobar, it's Khobar, Towers bombing, in which 19 U.S. servicemen were killed, and 498 of many nationalities were wounded in that attack. Now, we did see some open dialogue, just a little bit, in 1998 and 2000 with Iran. I don't know, that may have been our downfall, because on 9/11 in 2001, the 9/11 Commission report has concluded that 8 to 10 hijackers on 9/11 passed through Iran, and their travel was aided by an Iranian border guard, a senior operative of Hezbollah. He helped those hijackers from Saudi Arabia to Tehran. And a federal district court judge in Manhattan concluded that Iran was legally responsible for providing material support to the 9/11 plotters and hijackers. And again, as we keep that in mind, we're sitting there at a negotiations table, John Kerry, you know, all the other people sitting around negotiating with the people that have harmed, killed Americans and others. After 9/11 in 2001, in January of 2002, that's when Bush, as you might recall, gave his Axis of Evil speech, which called Iran and two other countries, they called them the Axis of Evil, and warned that their long-range missiles constituted terrorism and threatened the United States. Bush, on his second term, basically refused to talk with Iran, and for all the grief that he gets, and there are things that he's done. I feel he's a progressive, and in some regards, progressive left or right, still a progressive. But he looked at it and said, Iran is a threat to us, and we don't want to open dialogue with them. And there, so I think that was a really good thing that he did. And there are countless other examples from 2002. In which the United States has accused Iran of being a threat to the United States national security and even carried out, covert and other military-type actions within Iran. So what has changed to make Iran any less of a threat to the United States today than it was and always has been? Why are we so eager to sit down at a bargaining table and secure a nuclear weapons treaty with them, again, by tomorrow, this magical date of tomorrow? We have to get this done. And I would say, and listening to Eric and what he had to say, Eric Stackelbeck, I think they're even more a threat to us today than they have ever been. They're on their quest to reestablish the Persian Empire. And they continue to march along through the Middle East on their mission to do that, and will eventually, at least I think under this president, end up at our doorstep. And as we already know, they are already here. We know that. We've seen, the poor grandmother that was beheaded in Oklahoma because she wouldn't convert, I guess, to Islam. So we know that it's here. We know Fort Hood. That was no workplace violence. That was terrorism. The Iran-backed Houthis, again, are fighting to overthrow the Yemen government at the same time, again, that we're supporting Saudi Arabia. They are marching. They're trying to march into Saudi Arabia. They're just going to keep on marching, you know, into Israel. That's the final goal for over in the Middle East. And the final goal is the entire world. Again, the Obama administration has always been aware of this attempted incursion of Iran into Saudi Arabia and Iran's ultimate goal, and yet he continues to allow them to have whatever it seems that they want under this treaty. And the latest thing I heard is that, you know, without sanctions, we want to just lift the sanctions right now, just, you know, poof, they're gone. And what makes him think, and I'm not naive to think that, you know, he's not part of some other plan that he's doing, but, you know, what makes him think that these people can be trusted? You know, there's no way that we're going to be able to get in there and as inspectors and find out what's going on. It's just not going to happen. You and I both know that. It didn't happen in Iraq. It's not going to happen in Iran. And, you know, God only knows if they have the everything they need right now to make their nuclear weapons. My guess is if they don't have it, they could very easily get them, and we wouldn't even know that it was being done before it was too late. Even Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned this weekend that a possible deal with Iran was even worse than Israel had once feared. And he warned of a new Iranian axis, you know, in reference to what George Bush had said about the axis of evil. So a new Iranian axis. And saying basically that they were dangerous for all humanity. You know, Israel's not just saying, oh, we're, you know, it's dangerous to our interests, dangerous to all humanity, and they must be stopped. And again, anyone that they can't be trusted, that they're a danger. But what happens this weekend? Obama, you know, can't take time out for Iran. That's, we've got John Kerry handling that, so we can just go relax again. And he goes out and he plays golf in Florida. So he's on the golf course with his buddies in Florida while we have, you know, Yemen's under attack. The Middle East is on fire. People are being beheaded in Europe, in the United States, but the golf game is really important. Now, I saw a short little film today put out by the Clarion Project, and they're really concerned as well about this nuclear deal. And they, you know, they encourage everybody to contact their representatives. You know, to be honest with you, I don't know what the representatives can do anymore because it seems like they're not doing too much. We had those 47, I believe, Congress people write a letter to Iran saying to them, you know, this deal's not going to be any good with Obama right after he leaves, and, you know, on and on and on. I know what they were trying to do. My only criticism of that is that instead of writing a letter to Iran, you should be going to Obama and talking to him face-to-face, whatever you have to do, and talking to him about how he's really, I think, you know, overextending himself, let's just say, in the law, in what he's doing. The founders really meant for, on something particular like this, when there's such a dire interest here for the United States, that they meant for the president, the executive branch, and the legislative branch to work together because of the dire consequences from something like this. And you, again, I don't think people in America, there are a lot of people who aren't looking at this, but I don't think too many people are fooled about what's going on. This is very, very dangerous for all of us. And like I was saying on the clarionproject.org and their little video that they put out. Just recently, on March 21st, we have the Iranians chanting death to America. This is not, you know, 1979. This is not 1980 or 88 or 1995 or 2001. We're talking about a few days ago. 9 days ago. We're hearing death to America, and we're sitting down negotiating with them. And also a person from the International Atomic Energy Agency said, don't trust these people, in reference to Iran, because they feel that right now they're making explosive devices. We also hear on that video from the National Council of Resistance of Iran, a spokesperson who appears to be Iranian herself, saying they are not to be trusted. And I think part of the most telling part of that video clip is Netanyahu, who's saying that they will play hide and cheat with any inspector that may come to them in trying to figure out if they have these nuclear arms. It's dangerous. You know, we're playing with fire, and I have to think that this administration knows the same information that I have, knows how dangerous it is to be sitting down with somebody who we have seen over decades of how much they are our enemy, and we're sitting down and negotiating with them. You know, and if somebody needs to teach and take him off the golf course and teach him that old adage about, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me once, twice, shame on me, then somebody needs to do that, you know, because we've just gone so far beyond what seems to be, you know, reality anymore. We're in this upside down world that none of it makes sense. And kind of same thing is with Bo Bergdahl, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And let me remind you a little bit about him and how I want to tell you about his connection to Iran. You know, who could forget that such a touching ceremony in the Rose Garden with his parents and Obama, you know, walking, I guess it's, arm in arm is a little bit more than arm in arm, it's more like hands on the waist, you know, all the way down the walkway. It was very cozy. And now we have this person who's being charged with being a deserter. But at one point, parents were just cozying up to the president. He was cozying up to him, to them. And, you know, everybody who knows this man, I mean, we've had people on, you know, like his former roommate who says that this guy was a traitor and that the White House knew that even before the swap, that he was a traitor and that tended to leave his post. And now there's, you know, Bergdahl coming out and saying, I guess his defense team is going to say, well, you know, he was leaving because things were so bad and he just wanted to get to the other base or the other post somewhere so he could tell people just how bad things were. Well, we all know that, you know, it's got to be proven in the court of law, but it's not looking too good for him down that road. But what's so interesting is that, you know, for this one alleged deserter, we traded 5 detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And these people weren't schoolboys. These people were hardened criminals, hardened leaders of the Taliban, whose job it is to kill people. One of the people that we allowed out and we knew about just recently, like from 6 months ago, Mullah Mohammed Fazi, F-A-Z-I. He's Taliban's former defense minister, and he was one of the Taliban terrorists that were released from Gitmo. He's now in Iraq, serving in a leadership role for the Islamic State terrorists. So he's back. He's working hard for ISIS. He's heavily engaged in the murder of non-Sunni people in Iraq. And he was even classified in 2008 by the Pentagon as a high-risk person in the United States and is currently involved in the Islamic State caliphate. So he's right in there getting his hands dirty. And the only thing that he was required to do was to just go to Qatar or Qatar, however you want to pronounce it, for about, I think, a year. But, of course, you know, that didn't happen. But one of the things that the administration has now done, they placed him on the top priority drone strike list for terrorist targets. My guess is they want to get rid of this guy and this embarrassing situation so there won't be any more fallout and embarrassment to the White House and this administration and seeing that the person that they exchanged for this alleged deserter is now killing people and just right in there with ISIS. Another person, I won't even try to pronounce his name, he before going to Gitmo, had at the request of Iranian officials, again, our friend that we're negotiating with, had asked to discuss the brokering of a coalition between Iran's Northern Alliance and the Taliban to come against the United States. So in essence, the Iranian officials were offering to open the borders so that the Taliban could get into Afghanistan and fight against U.S. and coalition forces. Sounds like a really nice guy, right? So, you know, my thoughts are some of the people sitting around the table in that negotiation session may very well be some of these people that we let go. And this particular man was an honored Muslim cleric who was directly associated with Osama bin Laden and the Taliban Supreme Commander, Mullah Muhammad Omar. And the person I'm talking about, his last name is spelled K-H-A-I-R-K-H-W-A, in case you want to look that up for any reason. There were the other ones that were released, we really don't know so much what's happened to them, but they're probably have gone to join ISIS, and they're using their rank and power to usher in the Islamic Caliphate, as far as we can tell. But we have the White House communications director coming out and saying that, you know, release absolutely worth it. I don't know who it was worth it for. It certainly wasn't worth it to the United States and all that they're going to have possibly happen to them because these five detainees, these powerful men, these leaders in the Taliban, were released. And again, as I said, we're already seeing those repercussions right here in the United States. And, you know, it's time for everybody to wake up. I know the people listening here in our audience, they are wide awake. But we really need to do more than what we're doing. I mean, as we talked with Eric, you know, for the next couple of years until Obama is out of office, there's going to be the same thing happening, if not more, where we're seeing all of these things happening. We're not going to be doing anything to stop ISIS. We're just going to continue to allow this to happen. We're going to see probably more things happening, you know, I would say first in Europe, more so than here, and then on here. When the people that have been recruited, when they come back, more and more things in malls could possibly happen. More beheadings at work can happen, and all the while it's going to be looked at as workplace violence. But we need to do things such as report, you know, supporting our Congress as much as we can, getting out there, talking to people, getting them to wake up, and praying that this deal with Iran does not go through tomorrow. Because it's going to be a deal that is a one-sided deal that is going to help Iran and hurt the United States, I'm afraid. So I want to leave you with that. I thank you so much for being here tonight and joining me. We had a great guest. Again, I do encourage you to go out and get his book, ISIS Exposed. And if you feel up to it, get my book, Freedom's Fight, A Call to Remember. I think that you'll enjoy it. Until next week, God bless you. Stay safe. And we'll have another exciting guest for next week. Take care, everyone.